This is Jeff Blankford. My guest today, Phil Giraldi, is by now a familiar voice to regular listeners who takes on the world, and he's one I often turn to when discussing U.S. policy toward Israel and the actions of U.S. intelligence agencies, with which he has some experience, having served as CIA case officer and Israeli Army intelligence officer in Europe and the Middle East for more than 20 years. He is currently executive director of the Council for the National Interest, a 501c3 tax-deductible and educational foundation that seeks a more interest-based U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, whose website is www.councilforthenationalinterest.org. He writes frequently for the UNS Review, where I recently found an article that really intrigued me, Mutual Assured Destruction, about which is going to speak with him today. Welcome once again, Phil Giraldi, to Takes on the World.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Well, we're not going to be talking about Israel, I don't think, today, but North Korea, which is a hot spot. And your article, Mutual Assured Destruction, or MAD, used to be called, was the reassuring belief on the part of American people, and maybe the Russians, that since both countries had nuclear weapons and could easily destroy the other and the world with it, that we had nothing to worry about, but we're concerned, or we were led to believe, that our ability to intercept intercontinental ballistic missiles fired at us by another country keeps us safe. And you have written an article in which you conclude otherwise. Let's tell us about it.
Yeah, I mean, basically, as I said in my article, I said every once in a while you read something that makes you completely rethink your own thinking about a certain situation or the way something might develop. And that was this article that I read and that I quoted in my article that basically said, look, this whole concept of missile defense, of being able to shoot up your own missiles and knock down the enemy missiles from the sky, defending the homeland and so on and so forth, is in technical terms quite likely a complete fraud. That the government, the U.S. government, has been claiming a success rate in terms of testing these missiles at over 90%, but the reality is that it's probably closer to 0%. So, having read this, I did a little more research into the engineering and the physics of missile defense, and discovered that basically what they were saying was true, that the tests basically have been rigged to give the government the kind of positive results it wants, and that, as one of the experts said, it said the only way you shoot down an enemy incoming missile is if that enemy incoming missile cooperates with you. So anyway, as I say, it has important political ramifications, because if the American public even suspected that they were not safe from missile attack from a country like North Korea, it would completely change, I think, how people would be thinking of how we deal with these countries.
In yesterday's New York Times, there was an article in which President Trump told the Japanese, or whether he told Prime Minister Shinzo Abe or directly or to the Japanese media, he was disappointed that the Japanese had not shot down the North Korean missiles as they passed over northern Japan. And I remember when War Secretary James Mattis had said, the United States didn't do it because it was not a threat. But there is a real question of what would happen if one of these interceptors was fired in real time and missed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly why they don't test these systems in real life. Some of the reporting that I read about how they run these tests in such a fashion as to give all the advantage to the defense. They essentially do it when the light is very good. They do it at twilight, so the incoming missile is very clearly outlined. They increase the heat being generated by the missile, incoming missile, more than would be normal, so that the sensors on the counter missile can pick it up. They do a whole lot of things to make it work. And you're quite right. If one of these tests actually tried to shoot down a North Korean missile and missed, that would be a real eye opener, wouldn't it?
You know, I remember I've read over the years small stories, not big stories, small stories in the New York Times about these interceptor tests and how they have failed more often than not. And I do recall in the first Iraq War believing that many of the U.S. weapons that had been developed during the time of the Cold War, with the belief that they would never be used because a war would be with Russia and the Soviet Union and the U.S. was unthinkable, that these weapons actually were not up to the specs they were designed or supposedly designed for, and that they would fail. And I was actually quite amazed when the reports came in that these weapons were working, and then it turned out that they actually weren't working, and their test or the results of the bombing of Iraq were exaggerated. Do you recall that?
Yeah, I do. The so-called smart weapons and everything like that. They publicized where they would have a video showing that the thing worked, but of course the fact is they're not publicizing the many more frequent incidences where they didn't work. And that's the Pentagon selling itself, and something we should get used to. But the fact is, to me, the key issue here is if the President of the United States is selling an aggressive policy against a country somewhere in the world that has some kind of capability to hit us with a missile, whether it's nuclear-armed or not, and he's lying about our ability to defend against that, then somebody should be talking about this, because it should be changing how people in places like Seattle and Los Angeles are thinking in terms of the North Korean threat.
Perhaps you could give us some of the details that you describe in your article, you know, some of the specifics about the tests being carried out and what would be required. But this is a pretty comprehensive report that you had in the UNS Review, and it's quite interesting and should be quite worrisome for those people who believe that they have nothing to worry about here on the West Coast because we are totally protected by our wonderful intercontinental ballistic defense system.
Yeah, there is a defense system that's located in two places on the West Coast, in Alaska and in California. And this is the system that is generally referred to when they talk about missile defense interceptors. There are similar systems on the East Coast, but the major threat has always been seen as coming from the West. And anyway, these systems, the reality is when they fudge the math on these things, like, for example, if the actual real interception rate, even fooling around with how the target is set up and everything like that, even doing things like that, the actual interception rate in tests that have been run is more like 11%. But then what they do is they say, well, we would be firing multiple missiles and using certain arcane laws of mathematics. 11%, if you fire four missiles, becomes 97%. And it's been pointed out by engineers that this is, of course, nonsense, because if there is a flaw in the technology that enables the incoming missile to evade one of the interceptors, that flaw will also be present in the other three interceptors. So they're probably going to miss too. So it's all this kind of, you know, the government engaging in funny math and fuzzy tests and putting it all together and creating this false sense that the American mainland is basically protected against attack by a country like North Korea with a ballistic missile and possibly a nuclear warhead, because the fact appears to be that it's not.
Well, you point out, and actually you quote California Congressman John Garamendi, who has raised questions about it, and he says, The momentum of fear of the investments, the momentum of the industry carries it forward. What we are apparently seeing is simply a con job between the industries that manufacture these weapons. Is it Raytheon is one of them? I'm not sure that all the various industries that companies that manufacture them, but that these weapons simply are produced to manufacture profits for the manufacturers who give large amounts of money to members of Congress who really don't believe they're ever going to have to be used.
Yeah, that's, of course, the interesting sidebar. This is a perfect example of the military-industrial complex and how it functions. We have airplanes that don't fly very well, helicopters that crash. We have capital warships, aircraft carriers that are extremely vulnerable to the current generation of shore-to-ship missiles. All these things that don't work, that costs huge amounts of money, and the programs just keep continuing because there is. I saw one study that said the major military industrial suppliers like Raytheon, like Lockheed, they have plants in every state, and they even aspire to having plants in every congressional district. So there are jobs involved, and there's a lot of money to be made and a lot of money being thrown around. And it's frightening to think our national security is based on that kind of calculus.
Yeah, a job-based, profit-making calculus that actually the last thing that is taken into consideration is whether, in fact, the weapons will work. The F-35 fighter is another example. They just had to... not a recall, but it seems that this $100 million plus fighter, they didn't protect the screw holes, so they're already disintegrating. They're getting rusting, and so it's repairable, but it's just one problem after another. And you're supposed to have the most highest paid and most sophisticated engineers working on these planes, and a number of countries have bought into this system. This is the super jet fighter of the future for wars of the future, but it seems to be a boondoggle. And obviously many politicians, not just in the United States, but all over the world, have been bought by this into it.
Yeah, that's right. It's I was reading this morning an assessment of the Saudi military capabilities. And a good friend of mine who was a colonel in the army suggested in this article that the Saudi capabilities are best of their air force are best observed on the ground because they really have this highly expensive stuff that they with a lot of capabilities that they can't use or that don't actually work very well. And a lot of this stuff is just bought for show. And one of the F-35s, it's been plausibly claimed, was hit flying over Syria by a Russian missile system that's 40 years old, the S-200. And the Israelis have kind of denied it, but there have been reports that they've grounded the F-35s that they have because they're having problems with its alleged stealth capabilities.
Well, actually, we are talking about Israel. Israel is the only country that doesn't have to pay for their F-35s, but even they're complaining because actually some members of the Israeli Air Force did not want to buy the F-35. They much preferred the F-16, which is actually a reliable fighter. But obviously money changes hands, and they ended up they're going to get, I don't know, 50 eventually F-35s courtesy of the U.S. taxpayer. But perhaps they're going to ask to change the deal to get F-16s, all, of course, paid for by American taxpayers. It's the military-industrial complex has gone far beyond what President Eisenhower could ever have imagined, or maybe he did imagine it, because initially the words were changed. As I understand it, he said the military-industrial congressional complex.
Right, right.
Because,
yeah, he did, because he knew that Congress was complicit in this. He took the word out because some senior congressmen had complained to him about using it. But the fact is, this is a vast conspiracy where the American public is being bilked. And the media. I mean, you might as well throw the media in because the media is the one that creates the threat. They are constantly haranguing the public about the threat that comes from countries like Iran and from Russia and from China. The fact is that none of these none of these countries would be a threat if we weren't constantly in their face. And so, you know, the threat is kind of a self-made threat to ensure that the money keeps flowing.
My guest is Phil Giraldi, and we are talking about the U.S. weaponry and whether it works or not, and maybe we could shift to the enemy. How serious do you think a threat from North Korea is? We've had a warm armistice for half a century, more than half a century, and President Trump has said, we can't continue the same way as we've been doing for the last 25 years, but there hasn't been any war with Korea the last 25 years. He seems to want one. How do you evaluate, from your knowledge, North Korea's potential or danger to the United States?
Well, you know, I'm no expert on North Korea, far from it. But the fact is that it was always my understanding when I was in the CIA that the North Korea issue was that essentially North Korea has been agitating for a long time to end the Korean War. You know, there's only an armistice in place. There's a demilitarized zone that has behind it 30,000 U.S. troops who are essentially hostages to the situation. And North Korea, for years and years and years, wanted to basically end the war, sign a non-aggression agreement with the United States, and have the United States withdraw its troops and basically regularize the situation. So the fact that we've walked away from that for years for reasons that are not at all clear to me, and also we have basically closed the door right in the current situation on negotiations or diplomacy. So we're in a bind of our own making. Is North Korea a serious threat? I would say yeah. I would say that it appears that they are very close to having the ballistic missiles that could hit the United States West Coast. And they are, of course, developing nuclear warheads to go on that missile. They're doing it, to be nice about it, they're doing it defensively because the United States has overwhelming power in that region and has been threatening them. This is what all these countries have learned in the last 20 years, that if you want to defend yourself against the United States, you better have a nuclear weapon. And you know, so we've hung ourselves by our own petard here. That basically a situation that was resolvable, that should have been resolved years ago, has festered into something now that's quite dangerous. And my druthers, of course, would be that we really, really seriously opened the door to everything on the table, negotiations, discussing the whole status of the region, and finally ending the Korean War.
It seems impossible, however, with this administration, even I call him War Secretary Mattis. Remember when they changed it, War Secretary to Defense Secretary, and people just started repeating it. It's just ridiculous. When I was in the Army, it was a War Secretary. Mattis says, last week, I could not imagine a condition under which the United States would accept North Korea as a nuclear power. And Trump has said that in more harsh terms. So there is no basis of negotiation. It's obviously at this point, nothing, including China, is going to pressure North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons. They saw what happened with Libya. And also, they've seen what the Trump administration is trying to do with the Iran deal that was negotiated not only with the United States, but with the five nuclear powers plus Germany, and that those other countries mean nothing, of course, to the Trump administration. It's just an Obama victory of sorts that he wants to undo. But given that track record, it's obviously North Korea is not about to give up its nuclear program. No.
Yeah, I think that's clear. And the fact is, you know, you have everyone in the administration. You have Nikki Haley at the UN. You have Mattis. You have McMaster. You have the president himself all singing to the same tune, which is essentially that we don't want to negotiate anymore. And what North Korea has or is doing is unacceptable to us. And the clear message is that we are prepared to use military force to resolve it. But that's a you know, that's a non-starter. I mean, for apart from anything else, Seoul, the capital of South Korea, is within artillery range of the border, and the U.S. troops that we have stationed there are within easy artillery range, and also easy marching range from the vastly bigger North Korean army. So unless we're willing to do a first strike and obliterate North Korea, what is the solution? I don't get what Trump is trying to say, or what you would hope Mattis and McMaster would have understood things better, but they don't seem to.
And we don't get reports. There have been, of course, protests in South Korea, because the South Koreans, whose lives would be on the line, not at least ostensibly Americans, unless the North Koreans do successfully fire missiles that reach our coast, but the South Koreans would be the first to die in a confrontation with the North, and yet the United States has an agreement with the South that in a case of war, the United States military controls the South Korean military. So it's like we do not recognize South Korea's sovereignty in one of the most essential aspects of sovereignty, which is the right to defend itself.
Yeah, that's right. That's one of the stranger aspects of the armistice situation that still prevails, because technically the United States sees itself as the guarantor of the armistice that basically stopped the fighting. And this is ridiculous. I mean, this is something that's a historic anachronism, and it basically puts the United States in a hostage situation, because we have to have troops stationed there. We have to have troops stationed essentially right in the front line, and those people are also going to be the first ones to die. This is the whole thing makes no sense.
And here we have Trump as the arms salesman, and Shinzo Abe, even before Trump was elected, had decided to move Japan out of its peaceful, law-abiding, internationally respecting position that thanks to actually MacArthur after World War II had negotiated, so the Japanese army would not rebuild and be what it was before the war. And Shinzo Abe now believes it's time to change that and go back to being an imperial power. And here is Trump talking about how many weapons that Japan is going to buy from the United States and is going to provide jobs for Americans. That's his job program. It's an extraordinary, callous way of looking at the world, or looking at peoples of the world outside the United States. But if you comment on that.
Yeah, that's the fundamental issue with Americans is essentially that they have trouble putting themselves, we Americans have trouble putting ourselves in other people's shoes. We don't, once upon a time when America was more seriously an immigrant nation that had people from all over the world, when I was growing up and you were growing up, people did understand kind of foreign cultures, and because it was very close to them in terms of historic terms. But the United States has become more insular. And people are getting less news, less information. The average person is getting less than he used to get with Walter Cronkite and during the Vietnam War, for example. And so people are ignorant about what's going on in the world. They kind of think of these North Koreans as these funny little monkeys that if they screw around with us, we're just going to have to stomp on them. And too often, Americans and the U.S. have this kind of point of view when dealing with foreigners. They just see foreigners as an alien presence that really has no relevance to them in their daily life.
Well, we seem to be setting ourselves up as, well, not to continuing to even exaggerate that. We have Obama who very subtly expanded what George Bush had begun with AFRICOM. I mean, AFRICOM, which Bush started just before and initiated just before Obama was elected, we now find, and Congress seems to be bewildered about the number and whereabouts of U.S. troops in Africa, but the recent incident in Niger which most Americans couldn't find on the map, although it's twice the size of Texas. They probably never heard of it and wouldn't pronounce it properly. But this seemed to come as a surprise to members of Congress. How much do you think, you're been in Washington, around Washington, do members of Congress really have any idea what's going on in the world? Or they're just raising money all the time?
Well, they don't. Congressmen are dependent on their staffers, and their staffers provide a certain expertise, but their staffers are usually kids in their 20s or so, and they don't really have any, you know, actual world experience to, by and large. So congressmen get briefed up when there is a session, and they know the subject one inch deep, and that's all they know on it. They don't know, you know, seriously what the nuances are. They don't know what the countervailing arguments might be. For example, if you look at meetings by the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee or the House Foreign Affairs Committee, you'll see that every time they have a hearing, it's always the same crew that shows up. It's a bunch of neocons, by and large, who tell them what they think about Iran or what they think about the situation in North Africa. And they never get someone who is telling them anything different. So the short answer is that congressmen don't understand what's going on in the world at all.
Yeah, well, that reminds me, I'm going to switch gears. You might have seen this, but there were efforts by the Bush administration when the war started, when they invaded Iraq, to link Saddam Hussein with al-Qaeda. And that didn't work. And then attempts to link Iran with al-Qaeda. And now we've seen an article, declassified documents, which have kind of been taken off the headlines because of the tragedy in Texas and Russiagate, which we'll get into today. But that document, declassified documents, of among 470,000 found in Pakistan at bin Laden's hideout, show that there was collusion between a cooperation between al-Qaeda and Iran. And this seemed, and this these documents were given by the CIA, first access to two journalists, quote-unquote, from the Long War Journal, which is a project of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, an Israeli front group. And these two journalists are, quote, senior fellows there. This seems to be a kind of collusion and buildup for a war on Iran, possibly, similar to what we saw with Iraq. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think you nailed it. I think that I had the same feeling as I saw this play out. And you know, and actually the documents are not that themselves that compelling. It's just a question of how you interpret them, apparently, that makes them makes Iran indictable in their minds as an ally of al-Qaeda. There are 100 reasons why Iran has nothing but hatred for al-Qaeda and other Sunni radical groups that believe that Shiites should be killed on sight. And so, you know, it's a phony process being worked up here, and you're also seeing it play out in terms of what's going on with the Saudi Arabians and the Israelis, vis-a-vis Lebanon, vis-a-vis Yemen, where all this is being cranked up into a casus belli, which is going to be exploited fairly soon with some kind of major attack probably on Lebanon. And that, of course, will potentially draw Iran in, and Iran being drawn in will draw the United States in.
Well, this was what I was worried about when I read that Saad Hariri, the prime minister, Sunni prime minister of Lebanon, whose father was a major contractor and very close to the Saudi establishment before he was assassinated, that Hariri went to Saudi Arabia. And this, to me, was an ominous sign of perhaps an attack by somebody within the Saudi U.S.-Israel axis, which that's what it seems to be today, on Lebanon, on Hezbollah, and blaming Hezbollah for firing an Iranian rocket from Yemen into Riyadh. It just seems like a very contrived situation, which the media here is accepting as fact.
Yeah, that's exactly the way I see it, too. The whole situation is contrived. When Hariri fled for his life, as he is alleging, that was all prearranged. and the message that he was going to be giving about I'm leaving the country because Iran is taking us over is also a prearranged message, probably written with the help of the Saudi foreign ministry. And Israel is playing its part also in terms of the threat coming. Netanyahu had made a speech about it, I think, yesterday, where he emphasized that all of this was true, that the fact that he fled and everything should tell the world that Iran is a danger to the entire region and indeed to the entire world.
It never ends, and yet our media, is, as you pointed out, is part of the problem because you don't see any kind of analysis that would point a critical eye on either Israel or the Saudis. I mean, the Saudis have been criticized for bombing Yemen, but members of Congress can't even get a bill passed that would stop that, the U.S. providing the intelligence that allows the Yemeni people to be killed in the midst of a horrible cholera epidemic condemned by the U.N. and health authorities. It's like nothing is happening. We are selectively manipulated by those who are manipulating the media. I know your Council of National Interest has been one organization over the years which has tried gallantly to provide other perspectives, but then you don't have the media knocking on your door.
Right. That's a fact. It's better now in terms of we have the alternative media that's provided by the internet and by people like yourself who are doing what you do. But the fact is, to break through to the mainstream media is still the final barrier that has not taken place. You can't, shows like Democracy Now that pretend to be presenting a progressive point of view, sure, they do it on some issues that are safe, but they don't do it on serious issues, some of the serious issues like war and peace, where they should be talking, where they should be pushing hard. They don't do it.
Well, the pressures are on magazines like The Nation as well, seem to be overwhelming, and they're obviously subjects that can't be discussed. And one of them, I had mentioned on the air, is a group like the Friends of Israel Defense Forces have a dinner last week in Beverly Hills, raised close to $54 million with Oracle founder donating $16.6 million tax-exempt. That should be a news story because someone like Larry Ellison is always in the news, as is the host Haim Saban. But when it comes to this particular issue, they prefer the public not to see it. And so the public doesn't see it. And only on this broadcast, I told my listeners earlier, will they hear about the Friends of Israel Defense Forces, which raises millions of dollars tax-exempt for the benefit of a foreign army. When thousands of American vets are homeless in the streets, suffering PTSD, it's an extraordinary situation, and yet it continues. I know you've been fighting it, your articles you've been writing, and for the UNS Review, which I read regularly, which publishes articles that are often out of the box. But it's a very difficult challenge what to do, particularly when there's no military draft, to get youth involved. You find students today, they have their heads in their cell phones. It's a difficult, difficult problem. It's a challenge, and it's depressing when you see a war building up all around us, as you have seen it yourself.
Yeah, absolutely right. And the Friends of the Israel Defense Forces is one particularly egregious example of how bad it is, because this is a registered charity with the United States Treasury. That's why it's your contributions to it are tax exempt, and it goes to support a foreign army. This money, I don't know if you've been following in England. There's been a big brouhaha about the Minister for Foreign Development, a woman named P.T. Patel, who did a private tour of Israel sponsored by the Conservative Friends of Israel. She met Netanyahu. She went back to England and was recommending that they use development funds coming from England to pay for Israeli army hospitals. So there's been a big stink about that. This is happening everywhere. It's the problem is that the Israel lobby is probably the most powerful foreign policy lobby worldwide. I mean, it works in a lot of countries. It works in France. It works in England. It works in Australia, New Zealand, United States, Canada. And they get their way. And eventually, you know, if they want money, if they want money to go to Israel, it doesn't matter what the logic of the situation is or what the country, our country, should be standing for in terms of principles. It happens.
Well, the situation in England with Ms. Patel, who, curiously enough, is coincidentally enough, is also of Indian descent, as is Nikki Haley, our pro-Israel representative at the UN. She took an Israeli lobbyist with her in all these meetings, and she may have to lose her job, but what she did was actually par for the course for the United States. I don't think it'd be a problem if an American official did that, and they do that. We've come to the end of the hour. Phil Giraldi, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today. You could follow Phil Giraldi's articles in the UNS Review and also at the Council of National Interest website. That's Council of National Interest, one word, .org. Phil, thanks so much for being our guest today again on Takes on the World, sharing your thoughts.
Thank you very much for having me on, Jeff.
Take care. This has been Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.